And again, we have the privilege of turning to the book of Matthew and Matthew chapter 2. However, tonight we want to go beyond that verse 12. Want to start reading at verse 13 and reading then through the end of the chapter. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said. "Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious. And he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, having been warned in a dream, another dream. He withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, "He will be called the Nazarene." Our text tonight coming from verse 18. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. No matter what age you are, you know that so often Christmas begins with great anticipation and joy and excitement. When the family clan gets together and all the cousins, the aunts and the uncles and the whole clan get together, what a joy it is to see these children come into the house for grandpa and grandma or whatever house you meet in. When they first come through the doors, what a beautiful thing it is. The children are so excited, they can hardly contain themselves. They're on high octane. Of course, it may be that they've had lots and lots of sugar come down their throats, but they're on high octane. They're so excited, and the cousins are so happy to see each other, and it's just joy, joy, joy. Then comes a Christmas meal, if it's your family clan like our family clan, and with this Christmas meal, everybody seems to turn out, and there's a whole big meal, and then there's dessert besides, and if your family clan is like ours, then there's all these goodies and candies and cakes and cookies and bars and whatnot all, and by the time the afternoon is halfway over, the sugar is really pulsating through the veins, and the children are next to beside themselves with joy. Then comes the opening of the presents. When the presents are open, never mind mom or grandma or auntie spent tedious hours putting those presents all together. Such beautiful work some of our lady folks do. I really haven't met many men that can dress a Christmas present as well as the ladies can. But so neatly put together in these beautiful bowls and little curlies and bows and ribbons and whatnot, all in these little children receive these gifts and they're so excited. Never mind what grandma or auntie or mom have done. Just tear it to shreds and got to get it the present. And at a certain point in life, getting a gift means nothing at Christmas time. Watching the face of children is such a delight, isn't it? And the cameras are out and the cameras are flashing to catch on film that moment or to catch on digital memory something that might show up 20-some years later at a wedding video. But as the day wears on and the adults keep talking, the children's high adrenaline seems to fade. And so often on Christmas that started out so beautiful with cousins getting along in perfect fashion has a turn somewhere through the afternoon or evening. The cousins, having been up too late the night before, might start arguing over a boy or a toy or a girl, and the tears flow. Yeah, that's part of Christmas too. Or in certain family clans, it seems as though a certain brother-in-law can come out with some crude comment and a certain sister-in-law takes offense, and suddenly somebody jumps from the chair and disappears into the bathroom to dress their eyes and make it look presentable again, and a few minutes later they slip back in and the mood has changed. Or when everything seems to be going pretty good, somebody comes along and says a certain name. And it's amazing sometimes that when you're in emotional high, you're not ready for it. And when that name hits and the pain of their absence strikes like a dagger into your soul, then the great joy of Christmas seems to evaporate. And you miss that loved one so utterly much, though you would never ask God to reverse the calendar. And the tears flow. But that's nothing new. Read the Christmas story. And here in Matthew chapter 2, you've got it. Verses 1 through 11, 1 through 12 seem to be remarkable and beautiful. And then suddenly there's this business about Rachel and the unresolved, inexplainable grief. That too is part of the Christmas story. That too God put into the plan. Just as the inexplainable to you, the incomprehensible to me, the puzzles and the mystery on planet Earth that cause so much tears in today's world, that too is part of His plan. And someday, He will explain it to you. So here you have this passage. There's basically four scenes in this passage. Scene upon scene upon scene in one text. Starts out, verse 18. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children. What's the story there? The story has a flashback all the way to Genesis chapter 35. Beautiful Rachel with her beautiful hair and her beautiful face and her beautiful eyes, with her athletic body, the beautiful love that was between Jacob and Rachel. But into that marriage, God did not give children. Rachel went close to 14 years, no children. And finally, God gave a pregnancy and a little baby Joseph. And then God gave a second pregnancy, and Jacob gets it in his head that he has to leave the land of his in-laws. Jacob gets it in his head that he has to go back and see father and mother, Isaac and Rebekah. No, correction. When Jacob left his home 20 years earlier, Jacob never saw Mother Rebekah again. But Jacob gets it in his head, he's going to go all the way back to Mamre, where Isaac, Father Isaac, is getting old and blind. He's going to see him. And they're on the road, and lo and behold, they're coming down from the north. You and I would call it the country of Lebanon. Then through Galilee, through Samaria, and they get as far as Ramah. And Rachel can go no further. For 6 miles north of Bethlehem is Jerusalem. And 6 miles north of Jerusalem is a little place in the road called Ramah. Rachel goes into labor. Severe, ugly, awful labor. And in the tent that they hastily pitched for her, she's going through the strenuousness of it all. And Rachel, as the text says, is crying. Because Rachel is dying. And Rachel knows it. Please explain that to me, would you? I don't comprehend it. You and I have never died. You and I wouldn't know what it feels like. And yet, as I think back on this past year, 2011, I know of 3 cases from this congregation of people that knew in advance the Lord was calling them home. And they told their family members, emphatically, even if the family members would not believe. And they were right. They knew they were dying. And they knew they were about to depart planet Earth and step into the Lord's presence. It's beautiful stuff, but don't ask me how. Rachel is crying, and Rachel is dying. Why? Because she knows these 2 little boys of hers will have to go on and live their lives without their mama. Rachel calls this little baby Ben-Ami, son of my sorrow. And then maid trying to help her tries to cheer her up, and she refuses it because she knows Rachel is right. After her death, Jacob knows Ramah is no place. So he gives the command. The caravan starts up again. They start south, except now they've got a stretcher. And 4 of the servants are carrying this stretcher with the pall cloth over it, which is why we call it pallbearers at the corners. They're coming south, 12 miles to get to Bethlehem. Jacob wanted to get all the way to Mamre to see his dad. But 11 miles south, 1 mile from Bethlehem, Jacob cannot take it one step further. He gives the command. They stop. They have a funeral, and they bury Rachel's body 1 mile from Bethlehem. If you take a tour of Israel, as we did in 96, you may have your little bus or taxi stop right there, beside the road, the monument of Rachel's tomb, still there yet today. Scene 2. Jeremiah 31, verse 15. The voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children. What's that? 1,500 years later, Nebuchadnezzar sends his troops into the land of Israel because the Israelites were all disobedient to the Lord. They weren't following the Lord's word. They weren't following the Lord's commands. There was sin all throughout that society. There was idolatry and adultery and murder and greed and whatnot all. And finally, God can take it no longer. And finally, in we would say desperation, but God is never desperate. In drastic measures, he sends Nebuchadnezzar's troops into the land and they slaughter left and right. Troops are slaughtered. People are killed. People die in the famines. And finally, at a place called Ramah, 6 miles north of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar's troops set up a war camp. And as they're sorting through the prisoners, old timers that aren't going to make the journey anyway, catch the sword. A few beggars dressed in rags are set free because they have no land anyway. Somebody's got to tend the weeds. Sons and daughters of the finest order are stripped of their clothes, adorned with ropes, tied behind camels, and taken off to Babylon to be slaves, never to return to the homeland again. And the mothers of Ramah, the mothers of Israel, are weeping. Some of their children have been killed in battle. Some of their loved ones have been slain in the famine. And some of them are going off to slavery. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel's daughters weeping for their children. Scene 3. 600 years later, Christmas. What joy, and you know the story very, very well. The wise men come into the picture. The wise men ask Herod where the Christ child is going to be born. He says, according to the consultation he makes, Bethlehem. The wise men head 6 miles south to Bethlehem, and they have this wonderful experience of worshiping at the side of the cradle of the Christ child. And immediately afterwards, verse 12, the wise men are warned, don't go back through Jerusalem. Amazing what God accomplishes through dreams and a lonely star. So the wise men head out of town. Herod is absolutely furious, but God knows that too in advance. And in advance, God gives to Joseph this dream. Herod's going to want to kill this child. Don't you love Joseph? It's almost amazing that every family doesn't have a boy named Joseph. What a fabulous good man. He's given a dream, he acts. He's given a dream, he acts. He gives a dream, he jumps up in the middle of the night. He takes the gold, the myrrh, and the frankincense, good stuff with which to finance an extended stay in Egypt. And in the middle of the night, they walk out of town. They're out of sight and over the horizon by the time the troops of Herod come in, surround the town. And try to fathom, could you? Try to fathom what happened in Bethlehem that night. from house to house to house. Wherever a baby boy is, there the sword gets rammed through and the child is dropped on the ground. Let me interrupt. You know that we spent 7 years down out in South Dakota? There was a ritual every fall. Out there in the prairie, when the ranchers would have to gather in the cattle. It usually took place in October or November. With their horses down in the river valley along the Missouri River. Beautiful territory if you ever get to see it. On flatter land, they could use four-wheelers. They would bring all those cattle in from the far edges of the pasture. The mother cows and her calves, the bulls, bring them all in up to the buildings and put them through the corrals. Separate the bulls out first. Then they would go through the process of separating cow from calf and calf from cow. Mind you, with those little calves being born in March, February, maybe April, those calves having sucked off their mamas all summer long, plus eating grass, now they're up to 500, 600 pounds, time to wean those calves. What a sound. When they would separate the mamas from the babies, and the mamas would be on one side of the corral fence, and the babies on the other side of the corral fence, can you imagine what would happen? Those mamas have spent that whole summer with those babies. They could find each other even if they're separated by 200 acres and five hills. Mamas bawling for their babies. The babies bawling for the mamas. Hour after hour after hour. First day, first night, second day, second night, third day. Along about the third night, the mamas can no longer bawl because their voices are hoarse. The babies can no longer bawl because their voices are hoarse. And it's over. We sang Silent Night, Holy Night. But the night after Herod's men got done, Bethlehem was not silent, and it was not holy. It was a horrible ruckus, and the noise was deafening. But how do you explain that? Scene 4, today's modern world. Look around you, and what do you see? Americans are such eternal optimists. It's astounding, isn't it? A tornado rips through Joplin. They see all the destruction. And what do the news cameras focus on? Some little child has been spared. Happy ending. Or some dog that was rescued. Isn't it nice? Look across the landscape of southern Michigan. How much harmony and peace and love do you see? Town after town after town. And how do you explain crime and loneliness? And grief. And adultery. And abortion. How do you put it into the mix? But somehow, according to this, the mothers of Bethlehem have to go on and they cannot explain it. The mothers of Bethlehem the day after are left dumbfounded. Some of you have witnessed inexplicable death. Who could explain to these moms why these little babies had to all lose their lives? Oh, but God always has a reason. And God always, in His infinite eternal plan, has something behind it. For God does nothing by accident. And no, we're not Muslims who think that God is sometimes willy-nilly. He'll sometimes throw out judgment like lightning strokes from the clouds. And sometimes He'll toss out mercy like candy from a clown's bag. No, we're not. We don't believe that God is willy-nilly. We don't believe that God happens to do something, or things happen and His hands are tied and He cannot fix it. What's behind this? It's the wrapping of the Christmas paper. Torn to shreds and discarded, only to be gathered up into the garbage and put into the dumpster or the incinerator barrel or the Herbie Kirby. So in the spring of the year, the farmer goes out and, after tilling that field, comes in with the planter. Those seeds are all dropped into the ground. The seed grows and sprouts, and if that farmer is taking good care of it, it can grow out of that seed a beautiful tall corn plant. And best of growing conditions, the corn plant stands tall and strong and shoots out an ear or two. And those ears can be long and full, a beautiful picture of health. But that corn plant cannot understand what's coming its way. For at a certain moment, the combine comes into the field, and that tall, beautiful corn plant has spent its whole year so far living in the best of conditions is suddenly shredded. The ears are torn from their stems. The husk is shredded from the cob. The cob itself is demolished, and the corn kernels all go down through the sieve up into the hopper, and the corn plant and its leaves and the husk and the cob are pulverized and put out the rear end of that combine like garbage on the field. These babies in Bethlehem, what did they have to do with the Christ child? They were the first of the martyrs of the Christian church. And because of their death, everybody in Israel knew that Herod was scared of a Messiah. But those poor moms in Bethlehem, how would you have come alongside of them? How could you have said some trite little statement like, God has a way, He takes only the best. Someday you'll understand. Instead, you and I have to take anchor in His Word, knowing His promises are real. And then, someday, when your battle has been fought, when your race is done, when you finish the fight, when victory is won, then He will call you to His home on high so you can live with Him above the sky. And then, in tenderness, He will take away your fear. And with arms around you, He will remove every tear.